Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rucca. Wage inequality was the subject of a public discussion sponsored by AAUW and the Lower Columbia Diversity Project. On the panel were Shauna Sykes of the Oregon Employment Department, Rahi Reddy of the Labor Education Research Center, Barbara Bird of the Oregon AFL-CIO, Constance Weissenen of Thrivent Financial, and Jeannie Atkins, Oregon's new Secretary of State. In our area, women are paid 76 cents for every dollar paid to men, resulting in a yearly wage gap of $14,027 between full-time working men and women. We've edited the two-hour discussion down to a half hour, and Shauna Sykes leads things off with some numbers on pay and education.
Median earnings for male full-time year-round workers, $47,821. Median earnings for female full-time year-round workers was $31,000, huge gap. Statewide, in the younger years, from 14 to 24, women actually outnumber men in the workforce. And then again, between 55 and 64, there are actually more women than men employed. The middle years between 25 and 54, and then again from 65 to 99, which I thought was strange, men actually still outnumber women. And there's an interesting thing happening statewide and in Clatsop County. In the younger age groups from 18 to 44, there are more women with a bachelor's degree or higher education than men. As you look at the older population, even the 40 to 64, the gap is not very large, about 1%. And then those 65 and older, there are significantly more men than women with a bachelor's degree or higher. Basically, across every age group, women make less than men in Clatsop County. Women tend to work less hours than men in Clatsop County, and a higher percentage of women don't work at all, 26% versus 18% of men. In the full-time work category, 61% of men work 35 or more hours per week, where 42% of women work 35 or more hours. So that is going to be part of the reason why women earn less. The gap between men and women, the number of men and women in the workforce has narrowed. The percentage of women with a bachelor's degree or higher is progressing as far as the younger women more likely to have a bachelor's degree than men. Earnings are higher for men than women in every industry, age group, and occupational group in Clatsop County. And just in general, women usually work less hours per week and less weeks per year than men overall.
Hello, everybody. My name is Rahi Reddy. I'm a faculty member at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. And I'm going to just talk briefly about a new report that we released in January called The High Cost of Low Wages in Oregon. And I actually made a copy of our executive summary for you all to have. It's at the front table there that kind of summarizes some of the data. But you can also go to our website at lerc.uoregon.edu and download the full report. So it's totally available for you. So today I was going to just, you know, kind of jumping off from Shauna, get into a little bit more detail about who are low-wage workers in Oregon. Because when you talk about women and work, you're also talking about the low-wage economy in this state. And what we found in Oregon, and similar to what the Oregon Employment Department talked about, is 25% of Oregon workers would be considered what we call low-wage workers. And the way we define that is earning wage median wage of $12 an hour or less, which is far above what the minimum wage is, and earning an average, you know, yearly salary of $25,000 or less. And what we did is we used that kind of threshold to look at, well, how many workers fall into these categories and these jobs? And we found that 25% of these workers do. We then wanted to figure out, okay, who are these workers and how would we break them down? And as appropriately so, as we're talking today, many of these workers are women and people of color. So 50% of all women workers in the state are employed in low-wage industries. 54% of female-headed households, which is becoming more and more the norm of the type of households in the state, are earning less than $25,000 a year. You've also already heard, you know, 60% of minimum wage workers are women. And, you know, for us it really was, it's not just a low wage issue, it's a women's issue of what this economy is. I think the other sobering piece to think about and kind of very much reflected in what Shauna presented is that the low-wage sector is a growing sector. It's a thriving sector. And what's happened in the last 30 years of this state is there's a polarization. There's a growth in the low-wage sector, and there's growing, you know, somewhat, you know, growth in the high-wage sector. And middle-wage jobs, jobs that you all have seen disappeared from this region, middle-wage jobs are disappearing, and more of them are being replaced by low-wage work. So for us, we were like, it's really important to dig deep and to understand the low-wage economy, not because everybody's working in low-wage jobs, but more and more share of our employment and the future employment of our state is going to be low-wage. So when you think about what are these low-wage jobs, these are the occupations that we consider low-wage. Sales and retail, food prep and serving, which falls into public and private, right? There's food prep and serving in public institutions as well. Personal care, which is really, you know, all of these personal care services, home health services that are not certified home health aides, building and grounds maintenance, so landscaping and other types of maintenance positions, and healthcare support. So it's true that healthcare as an industry could have a variety and a spectrum of high and low wage jobs, but what is rapidly growing is home health aides, in-home support services. So when you look at the sectors that are growing in the not only in Oregon, but nationally, these are the jobs we're talking about. Statewide, you look at also what are the job openings? What are the new jobs that are being created? And the Employment Department does a really good job of publishing quarterly reports of like where jobs are they full-time, part-time? And we know that more and more jobs, especially out of the major metropolitan areas, are low-wage jobs and they're part-time jobs. We took a snapshot of the first quarter, 2014, the first quarter, of the number of working people that are on public assistance in the state. And unlike the popular mythology, folks that are on public assistance, whether it's SNAP benefits and food assistance and healthcare support, these mostly are working Oregonians. 40% of them are working Oregonians. So we looked at, wow, that's kind of interesting. So you're on public assistance and you're working in jobs. What are those jobs? And why aren't those jobs yielding a livelihood that you don't have to qualify for public assistance? So what we looked at in our report was there were 197,000 Oregonians that were on public assistance who are working. That number is 1 in 7 of all working Oregonians are on public assistance. So when we look at like the amount of public dollars that go into supporting these folks who really need it because the earnings that they garner are not enough to support their families, it results in about $1.7 billion of taxpayer money that's going to support these workers. How does that reflect in real people's lives here in Oregon? And here's what we learned. The women we interviewed from all over the state, their average monthly earnings was about $1,300 a month. And many of these women had young children in the home. Many of these women, 80% of them were working. 46% of them had some college or college degree. So when we hear about, well, you should earn low wages because you're low skilled and don't have an education, like that's just not true. And we've had stories in our set of interviews of women actually going back to school to try to like raise their kind of marketability, and the jobs just weren't there to like support them post an education. I think the most dramatic component of low-wage work is the quality of work. So hours and the quality and the lack of quality and the instability of work that also shaped low-wage work for these women. A major part of the struggle that they had to make ends meet was because of job churning. So 53% of the parents we interviewed changed jobs in a two-year period. 59% had spell of unemployment during that time. 18% of the women were unemployed at the time we met them, but were employed just prior. And job churning had a lot of, like causes, but one of them was just the inability to find full-time work, the inability to find stable work, and the inability to deal with this next issue, which was erratic and non-standard schedules. So parents that we interviewed, 54% of them had schedules that changed weekly. Can you imagine when your children were young or your children are young now, changing your schedule weekly and having to juggle childcare arrangements every week and not knowing till the week of? 69% worked non-standard hours, which means basically they didn't have a set schedule. And Terry, one of our interviewees, she said, they say you're going to have a set schedule, and you'd work that schedule for 2 months. And everybody's happy. Kids are well-adjusted. And then we're going to change your schedule. So many of the women we interviewed, it was just really hard to stay in the jobs that had the erratic schedule, so we looked for other employment. The nature of low-wage work, especially in retail, fast food, what we found nationally, too, is that these jobs create havoc for families. The other kind of spells of employment and unemployment was around paid sick leave and lack of. So many of these women have children at home, families that they must care for, and when their kids get sick, they have a really hard time if they don't have paid sick leave to take the time off to care for their children. There's no protection. So only 39% of our interviewees had paid sick leave. We actually interviewed women who lost jobs because one of our interviewees, her son had asthma, and she had to be out because of that illness, and the employer fired her for taking too much time off or taking any time off at all. We know that low-wage jobs are prevalent. We know that workers work in them. We also know that people want to do better for themselves. These women they don't want to be on public assistance. They want to be able to make ends meet. They want to be able to stay in jobs and work the hours, actually want to work more hours and more stable hours, but they can't. And so Abby, who actually went back to school, got an associate's degree, incurred a lot of debt to go back to school, came out, and she couldn't find work in the, at a higher wage rate than what she thought when she went to school. It was like, I'm going to have an associate's degree. I'm going to go get a job that's going to be pay better than Arby's. And she ended up going back to working at Arby's again. And she said, there just aren't a lot of ways to make enough money to do anything. I work pretty hard, even though I'm just a fast food worker. People say you don't deserve to make enough money to live because you work at Arby's. But I work pretty hard. We had several of our interviewees who say, I have to make the decision between paying for childcare and paying rent. And unfortunately, when it's about wages are so low that that's the way you have to juggle life, it's really incredibly hard. And many of these women are really grateful to have the ERDC, the employment-related daycare subsidy from the state in order to even work. There's a lot of mythology about low-wage work, that it is just part-time, and it's just teens, who are, doing this work. And the reality is the average low-wage worker, the profile is a woman in her 30s with young children. That is the national kind of picture of a low-wage worker in our country.
So my name is Barbara Bird. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're an umbrella organization. We represent about 130,000 union members here in the state of Oregon. Yeah, there are 7 million union women in this country, 7 million women that are working with a union contract, and they're better off than their non-union peers. And I want to show you kind of the financial aspects of that and then talk a little bit about some of the other things that are going on. So union women make more money than their non-union counterparts. They make about 20% more, $2.50 an hour more on average. That's even after controlling for things like age and race and amount of education and so on. But this is particularly strong, this effect, the union advantage effect is particularly strong for women that have less formal education. On average, also, unionized women who are women of color earn 35% more than their counterparts. So less formal education, women of color, even better off being in a union. And I will also say that for women workers, the union advantage is about the same as a full year of college. And they're even better off in terms of health benefits. So they're 30% more likely to have health benefits. And that is true at every education level. In fact, for women workers with high school degree, if they're represented by a union, they are as likely to have health insurance as a woman with a college education. So the advantage is strong and particularly in that area of healthcare benefits. Other area where you see these financial benefits is in retirement security. 53% more likely to have retirement security. And some of us are really glad about that. I think that we tend to think about wages and benefits, but the retirement security for a lot of women is just as important, if not more important, and is a strong effect that you see across the board and across occupations. It's not just money. That women have an advantage at work when they're working under a union contract because their rights are protected, because their jobs are protected. They have some sort of due process if their employment is threatened in some way. They have protection against discrimination. They have protections against harassment on the job. And those sorts of things, I think, are probably for a lot of women just as important as the financial benefits.
Constance Weissman, it's good to be here. She's had a lot of workforce experience in Clatsop County, and she's going to share some of that with us.
I have a degree in chemical engineering. I came here out of the University of California and started my career at the Wanna Mill. I started in management and worked there for 27 years, progressing to various management careers. Okay, who can give me a stereotype of what an engineer is like? What would be the first word? What's the first word that comes to your mind? You can say it. It's okay.
Nerdy.
Got it. And that is true of male engineers. And I don't mean to sound sexist, but it really is. They tend to be introverted. They tend to be very intelligent. And they tend to have, like, the personality of a gnat. Now, the reason I'm saying this is because in my experience, women engineers, if they fit that stereotype, will fail. It's one of those situations where if you come in as a woman and you are not assertive in that profession, they will eat you alive. And I saw it happen, unfortunately, to a number of very highly qualified candidates. And those women moved out of the engineering profession. I think it's one of the reasons, too, that women don't go into the profession because it doesn't appeal to them because of some of those aspects. So, my career at WANA, I can't complain. It put my children through college. It allowed me as a single mom to build my own home and to have a good life. But as I progressed, I kept continually seeing the invisible prejudice and the prejudice that's so built into our culture. And when I say our culture, I'm not saying men's culture, our culture, women and men. We just don't sometimes see women in certain roles. It's still hard for us to see women as leaders. It's still hard for us to see women taking that CEO position. That glass ceiling is very real. top of my head should be flat by now. It was just very difficult for me to get viewed the same as the men, despite my qualifications, to the extent that I started to doubt myself. I started to feel myself, well, maybe I'm not quite as qualified. Maybe I'm not quite as smart. Maybe I don't. And then I go, like, BS, you know? You have the same degree. You've been doing the same work. I would look at my projects. I remember one time in particular, we had a little bonus. When I'm saying a little bonus, I mean a little bonus, $250. Now, I will not do a whole lot for $250, okay? $250 bonus for all of the workers, except guess who didn't get one? Now, like I say, $250 was not going to make my life. It was not going to give my kids a master's degree. But you can imagine how frustrated I was with it. And so I went back through, and I looked through what I had done that year. I had just finished a project that saved WANA $1.6 million. I had discovered it's a complicated project, but it was basically in the paper transit situation. I had all of the documentation, including a letter from one of the VPs at Atlanta, in my files. Now, you can imagine I'm just feeling a little steamy, a little PO'd. So I tromped down to my boss's office with my little letter from the VP, and I said, so, I'm just wondering, $1.6 million wasn't enough, so how much did the guys save you each this year? What was the average amount of money each of the guys saved you? This is just one of my projects. Nothing. Took it to HR. Nothing. It just that built-in prejudice, and hugely frustrating. I don't think they even did it to be evil. I just think they simply couldn't hear me. They just couldn't hear me. In any case, after the after being turned down for my $250 bonus, I really started assessing my life. And I said, you know, I'm going to keep hitting the glass ceiling here. Even if I break through it, they're going to send me someplace lovely like Crossett, Arkansas. If you're from Arkansas, I apologize, but it wasn't my dream to go there. I'm ready to make a change. And so I spent a year evaluating options, taking a look at what I did well, what were my skills, because I wanted to stay here in Clatsop County. I love Napa. I love the community organizations I'm a part of. I wanted to stay. And ended up at that point making a career transition, that was almost 10 years ago now, to working in the financial services industry. But interestingly enough, for the first time in my life, I had bosses calling me up and telling me I was doing a great job. It was like a shock. I realized in 27 years of making toilet paper for the world, all of you, nobody ever told me that I was valued. Not at all. And you don't even, again, you know, I was the boiled frog there. I'd been in it so long, I was used to just thinking that you can treat people without respect and that it's okay. And so that was my first shock. My second shock, or my second learning, was that I was able to do as well as a man. And the nice thing is, in this profession, because I am essentially, I own my own business, I get compensated for that. The harder I work, the more I get paid. It's as simple as that. There isn't any barrier. And it's really been kind of a nice contrast of careers to have those two experiences, to see how much I was actually becoming a believer that I wasn't, that I didn't have all the skills and qualifications for my job, even though I could say, I have the right degree for this job. I have a chemical engineering degree. I have the years of experience. I've worked hard. I work more than 50 hours a week, every single week. But even all of those things weren't enough when I was in a system that really didn't. And I'm not going to say they treat the men there well either, just to be honest, guys. They don't. The male engineers I know who work there don't get treated great, but at least they got paid better.
And again, we are very honored to have the Oregon Secretary of State, Jean Atkins, here, who's going to tell us how she's going to make it all better.
So I'm happy to represent the statewide leaders here, and I think I probably could say I represent all of them at this point. We have for statewide elected officials. State Treasurer Wheeler is working very hard on the issue of retirement security, and our governor is getting her feet wet as our governor. But we obviously, I can say personally, seems to have respect for women who've done things in this state and putting women forward. And Commissioner Avakian, who did indeed take on this issue of pay equity. The Bureau of Labor and Industries has a Civil Rights Advisory Committee, and the commissioner asked them to do a report on this question. And I'm sorry that I didn't think fast enough to bring copies, but you can find it online in the Bureau of Labor and Industries website. They evaluated this issue as complex and all the different pieces of it as you can imagine. I mean, there's getting rid of bias by making it illegal, and then you got to move on to how do you get those laws enforced, and what happens if somebody complains and they're retaliated against. How does workplace policies, erratic work things, you know, lack of available child care, the lack of paid or unpaid even leave to take care of family matters, the changing economy, and as was discussed, and the loss of middle class jobs, the challenge of organizing and workers coming together. They did kind of mull through a lot of those different things and come up with recommendations, some of which are being discussed at the legislature, so I'll try to quickly run through them. They actually had recommendations that had to do with outreach and public awareness, so yay, diversity committee, you know, getting that part of the job, you know, done, trying to get partnerships with employers who are doing a particularly good job, maybe starting to honor some of them. There were recommendations along that line to give some positive things. The educational and occupational programs, Job Corps, career technical education, all of the things that we're trying to aim at, STEM education, trying to particularly get young women engaged in those kinds of educational projects that will get them jobs, that will pay the best, give them the best opportunity for good pay. And then there's more legislation and monitoring, and how do we make sure that the portion of this which is due to bias, you know, we keep moving forward on it, getting getting to be eliminated. But it's really good to say that all of the, you know, almost all the issues we've raised here today are something that's kind of under discussion. There's something to move the state forward going on in the legislature, which isn't the only place for change to happen, but I hope you'll put your voice into that as well.
That's Oregon's new Secretary of State, Jean Atkins. You've been listening to a discussion of wage inequality on The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca.